The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Aurora Desotero. I am the new curator of the print and picture collection of the Free Library of Philadelphia. Just a little bit about Robert Looney, if no one knows. He is a phenomenal man who was the head of the collection from 1963 to 1986, at which point he did amazing things. He published Old Philadelphia, and we actually have a link to it on our Friends of Picks website and the images on our digital database. He also had a staff of seven, which is unheard of these days. And he, artists, researchers, students, teachers, all came to the collection to do research. And over the years, we've continued this. We had Joe Benford, who did a great job of getting an IMLS grant to digitize the collection. And then Karen Leitner, who preceded me, added artist books to the collection. So everyone has made a huge effort to kind of keep the momentum and the enthusiasm of the print and picture collection alive. But one of the problems is that we are not endowed. So we use this memorial event every year to fund the collection and to fund projects. So this year it was Blaise Tobias, and Steve Perloff who suggested the theme of documentary picks. And they did so much for it. I mean, they started the idea, and then they curated the exhibit, and then they found the panelists and the artists to be part of the exhibit. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to Blaise Tobias, who is going to be speaking and introducing the panelists. Thank you very much.
I'm very happy to have been invited to kind of co-curate this thing with Stephen. I've really appreciated the print and picture collection here over the years. It's a wonderful resource, and I hope you're all going to be coming to the reception and buying some things at the silent auction later so that the unendowed collection can have a little bit of an operating budget, which they really do need in order to continue their good work. So we have three panelists today, and the topic that we kind of gave them was challenges to documentary photography in the 21st century. You may have noticed the show is organized looking at documentary photography of Philadelphia from circa 1900, from circa 1950, and from circa 2000. So it gives some idea of the trajectory of the specifics of Philadelphia-based documentary, but also of the trajectory of documentary photography itself over that 100-year period. So the three panelists who we're delighted to have today, who are each going to be speaking from here, and then after the third panelist, they're going to be sitting over there, and they will be taking questions from the audience. But I do ask, when you have a question from the audience, please wait till someone brings you a microphone before asking the question so that everyone can hear it and so that it can be recorded, because this is being recorded to become a podcast. So I'm going to introduce all three speakers first and then let them just come and do their thing. A.D. Coleman is considered by many to be the Dean of American Photography Critics. I hope he doesn't mind that title. He is the author of at least eight books. The most famous probably is Light Readings, A Photography Critic's Writings, 1968 to 1978. He was the first photo critic for the New York Times, doing over 120 articles for them. He actually started writing in 1967, and he's contributed to the Village Voice when it was a good newspaper, and to the New York Observer and numerous publications worldwide. He received the first Art Critics Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, and that was in 1976. He was a Fulbright Scholar in 1994. American Photo Magazine named him one of the top 100 people in photography. And I can also say that he's developed recently a very strong interest in the photography of China and has traveled to China quite a bit and will be talking on Chinese photography at Moravian College on Tuesday evening. Okay. Nancy Brokaw is an independent arts writer and a senior lecturer at the University of the Arts. She received her AD in English from Brown University and an MFA in photography, which means she's a great writer on photography, from the University of Delaware. She was a senior contributing editor for the Photo Review, and she has written for a variety of other publications, including Image World, The Photography Collector, and Photography International. She received in 2003 a Pennsylvania Council on the Arts Fellowship for Arts Commentary, and in 2008, she was a fellow at the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts. And I can tell you, she writes a very good blog at nbrokaw.blogspot.com and has expanded her range well beyond photography nowadays to a wide variety of fine art. Daniel Traub is a Philadelphia-born photographer who currently divides his time among New York City, Shanghai, and Philadelphia. What a great set for Philadelphia to be in. As both a documentary photographer and videographer, he has been engaged since 1999 with several long-term projects in China. Over the past several years, he has also been turning his camera on Philadelphia. Traub's photographs have been exhibited around the world with solo exhibitions at the Catherine Edelman Gallery in Chicago and at the Prince Center here in Philadelphia. His documentary work has appeared in publications including the New York Times Magazine, the London Telegraph Magazine, and Time Magazine. In 2008, he was selected by the Photo District News as one of 30 photographers to watch. In 2009, he was one of 10 photographers selected to participate in the Hier Photo Festival in Hier, France. Traub has been the director of photography as well, photography videography, for numerous documentaries and reports, including PBS, German television ZDF, and Arte. So with that, we'll bring up our first speaker, A.D. Coleman.
Good afternoon, and thank you. Thank you also for coming indoors on this otherwise very beautiful sunny day outdoors. I just thought I would set up some talking points that perhaps we could use a little later as we have a more conversational relationship with each other. The first major shift that I think that's important to us in terms of the kinds of challenges that Blaise and Stephen asked us to speak about, to me, comes in the 1960s when, with the demise of what used to be called the picture press, Life magazine, Look magazine, et cetera, when documentary photographers began to shift their distribution attention for their works to books and exhibitions. Not that the books and exhibitions of documentary work hadn't happened before, but they became, I'd say, highlighted and emphasized in the 1960s. That's really, I think, the first major change in the distribution of what we broadly call documentary photography since the advent of the picture press in the 1920s. What begins to happen, however, in the 1980s is that books and exhibitions begin to become increasingly problematic. The price of paper goes up. The price of book production goes up. It turns out that because of the expense of that books become, in a certain sense, restricted, at least well-produced books of documentary photographs, become accessible only to people with a good bit of spending money, which means there's a class issue involved. Museum exhibitions become increasingly harder to schedule, and space at alternative spaces for documentary projects becomes harder to schedule, as a result of which there's an effect on the topicality, the ability to get a documentary project out in any time proximate to the issue involved, if it's an urgent issue of any sort. Then the book industry starts to collapse for a variety of reasons, mostly economics. And more recently, we've seen an almost complete collapse of the book industry, or an ongoing collapse of the book industry, and problems at museums and alternative spaces in terms of available funding. Meanwhile, of course, there's been the rise of the World Wide Web, And the logical next move, it seems to me, for documentary projects generally is electronic distribution, whether that's online distribution via web productions of different sorts and web-based presentations, or whether it's the online distribution of e-books and other PDF downloads, et cetera, via, you know, for use on iPads, Kindles, Nooks, et cetera, which would eliminate the middleman and eliminate the gatekeepers and vastly reduce the production cost and speed up the time frame of that exists between, or the time frame from resolution of the project to its availability to its potential audience. And online presentation could include, with ebooks, of course, could include some kind of PayPal fee for the ebook, or could include some kind of subscription option for a photographer's project, even a subscription option as the project that was conceived and initiated, which would be a direct maker-to-audience relationship that hasn't really existed in documentary photography up until now for the support of different kinds of projects. So instead of, let us say, you or I going out and buying one $50 book of documentary photographs by one person, we could conceivably donate $1 a piece via PayPal to 50 different ongoing documentary projects that had some kind of web base for receiving money and showing us the work in progress. We live in an increasingly surveilled world, as you all know, and this gives us such wonderful news as the Britisher, I think her name is Miriam Bale, throwing a cat into a dumpster. And we live in an increasingly citizen-surveilled or citizen-journalist world that gives us such things as the savage beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles and the murder of the woman now known as Nada worldwide, murdered in Iran during the protests over there last year. Some of this attention from what we might call vernacular photographers contributes to the strengthening of our democracy. Some of it is merely frivolous. But surveillance and crowdsourcing can never really replace long-term individual commitment to the exploration of a community or an issue or a theme, which is really what documentary photographers do and provide us with. So I think we would wait a very long time for the sort of surveillance cam or citizen journalist equivalent of monkeys with typewriters giving us Shakespeare to those same forces giving us a major documentary work of any kind. Today's documentarians are likely to have developed their practice in an academic environment that and an academic environment, moreover, that emphasizes what we broadly call fine art or creative photography, though some documentary photographers still come to the form from journalism school and photojournalism school, and some come to it on their own from other sources. However, they arrive at the doorway through which they enter the field of documentary, they're likely to move between documentary and fine art projects over the course of their careers, more so, I think, than photojournalists or documentary photographers did half a century ago. Robert Frank and Gene Smith are just two examples of earlier photographers who crossed over those lines in different ways, but I think we could cite many more today. And one result of the education of photographers in the fine art environment is the infiltration of fine art strategies of production and presentation into documentary projects. The late Masumi Hayashi, murdered in Cleveland a few years ago, her collage panoramas of the Japanese-American internment camps from World War II, in one of which she was born, is one example of that kind of overlap of or hybridization of fine art practice and documentary approaches. Tammy Cromer Campbell's use of a Holga camera to describe the chemical contamination of a small Texas town that some of you may be familiar with is another example. Almost all present-day documentary photographers and photojournalism also, seems to me, use fine art strategies of image organization, ways of framing, ways of organizing the material in the visual space that we would think of as having come out of fine art practice rather than out of traditional documentary concerns. As part of the ongoing critique of documentary practice that we've seen over the last 20 years, I think we're going to see an increasing number of faux documentary projects that use the conventions and the tropes and the memes of traditional documentaries to subvert the credibility of the documentary form. Johann von Kubert's Fauna is just one of countless examples of faux documentary projects out there. We're also going to see an increasing use of projects that involving the recontextualizing of existing photographs, ranging from the recontextualizing of vernacular images to re-photographic responses to notable images such as Mark Klett's ongoing long-term endeavor in the American Southwest and West. This combination of artistic and curatorial activity, that is the recontextualizing of images, actually goes back at least to the work of Paul Vanderbilt at mid-century in a Midwest Historical Society collection. But it's more familiar, perhaps, to many people in such examples as Michael Lessie's classic Wisconsin Death Trip. Now, any long-term representational photographic project, I think, tends toward the documentary as it progresses. Witness, for example, Sally Mann's family album project, Jacques Sturgis's periodic studies of the same people from infancy or childhood on into adulthood, Emmett Gowan's photographs of his family, Nick Nixon's photographs of his wife and her three sisters, etc. So this is true of many fine art projects. It's true, of course, of documentary projects. It's true of your own family album in certain ways. It's true of the files of your local photo studio, your local newspaper, etc. All of these archives, as they accumulate, add to our sense of our own visual history, become resources for our retrieving our visual history, and become, in one way or another, documentary. Photographers who are involved in documentary projects, as I see it, need to reconceptualize their approaches to subsidizing such ventures as corporate and federal and state and local and foundation monies become harder and harder to obtain, and as more and more people are competing for those monies. Certainly options for crowdfunding have begun to develop on the internet, and that seems to me to be one place where photographers could look. I'm blanking out on the name of the project right now, but you can actually post a project at a site online and invite people to contribute to it, and if you reach a certain goal, you get the money, and the site takes a certain small percentage of it. I think approaches like this need to be explored, because otherwise everybody is trying to dip from the same well. The creation of revenue streams from a product line, whether that's rights licensing, print-on-demand books, e-books, podcasts, or, as I already mentioned, some kind of subscription-based relationship to your audience, is going to replace reliance on a corporate and governmental and NGO subsidy structure, I think, over the next 20 to 25 years. All of this is going to lead schools necessarily to place increasing emphasis on project funding, digital rights management, image archive management, and other related skill sets as integral to the education of the young photographer, and perhaps particularly the education of the young documentarian, as the schools change in response to all of these shifts in culture and in information transmission. I've used the terms photography and photographer so far, but it's probably more accurate to refer henceforth to time-based artists or media artists, and time-based art and media art, That is, the very definitions and the very functions that photographers, or the people we used to think of as photographers, perform are shifting and evolving to incorporate a number of other technologies, a number of other methodologies, and a number of other kinds of materials, either materials they generate or materials that they obtain from other sources. So exploitations of the possibilities of the new digital technologies is going to transform documentary photography by encouraging the practitioners to collage or montage or assemble combinations of still and kinetic imagery, that is, still, video, film, etc., audio source material, textual material, some of which may already have been created, some of which they may create themselves, some of which may actually come into the project through a live streaming, real-time source. Self-generated and found and retrieved material will probably be part of this, and much more. So documentarians and their audiences alike are going to be involved in a collaborative reconfiguring of their understandings of the form that we have henceforth called documentary as it hybridizes and evolves in the context of a new technology. As a result of this, I predict that there's going to be some serious revisitation of the works specifically of Dorothea Lange and Paul Schuster Taylor, their classic book, An American Exodus, and W. Eugene Smith and Eileen Smith's classic book, Minamata, which I think are going to come to be seen as pioneering experiments, as prototype storyboards for multimedia projects decades ahead of their time, conceived, as it were, before the technologies that we now have were available to them, but projects that would have been perfect for those technologies. And while the technologies and the skill sets involved in lens-based communication, as I've been discussing, are going to change and evolve, the activity, the fundamental activity of witnessing and bearing witness to the condition of our world, to the state of our culture, and to the events and incidents of our private and public lives are going to continue. So with that, thank you, and I'll pick this up in the question and answer period.
They have slides here. Where are we? Blaze? Shall we put that? Where's the...
Okay, it's not mirrored. Do you want it to be
mirrored?
Yeah,
where is it? Yeah. A different mirroring place than where I'm used to seeing it.
Yeah.
Technology is grand.
So you want it mirrored?
Yes. Thank you very much. Okay, so when I started thinking about this topic, the challenges to photo documentary going forward, I, of course, started thinking historically because that's how I am. And specifically, I started thinking about how for many years now, we've been seeing a lot of work that seems to echo back from the 19th century. This is Paul Seawright on the right from Afghanistan, clearly channeling Roger Fenton in the Crimea. This is Robert Troladori on the right after Katrina, similar sensibility to Arnold Genz after the San Francisco earthquake of 1906, and of course, Joel Myrowitz at Ground Zero, and a really bad slide of George Wynard in Charleston, South Carolina at the end of the Civil War. Now, when I started studying photography in the 70s, the photojournal, the street shooter was still king in the documentary world. And Myrowitz is kind of exemplary here. He's this is Myrowitz on the left at 46 and Broadway, and again, 25 years later at Ground Zero, doing this very stately image, very, very different in feeling and tone. And again, it's not exactly news that the street shooting sort of lost its sway during this period. And there are a number of reasons why I think this happened. But the one that I'm really interested in here is the emergence of video as the major news delivery device. And the way that video was really just a whole lot better at creating this sense of the present moment that street shooting had actually set as its goal. So the thing is that now that we can log on and go to the YouTube or the New York Times site and watch the Japanese tsunami play out in real time, or what seems like real time, the question is, what do still photographers do? And I think one of the things that they are doing is this kind of what I think of as retrospective aftermath work, where they go in after the event has passed and they survey the wreckage. This is Richard Mizrach's work after Katrina. And they go in and they look at what's happened. They start thinking about consequences, and ideally they can be asking us to think more deeply about the event itself. Sorry. And I think you see this shift happen across the board. This is David H. Wells. Started out as a newspaper stringer, so the news hounds are doing this kind of work. That is from his Foreclosed Dreams series. This is Todd Hedo from his same topic, but coming from a more art world bent. On the left, you have a New York Times photograph. On the right, Robert Polidori again, now after Chernobyl. So, and this is Andrew Moore's work from Detroit, the Model T headquarters on the left and the Rouge on the right. And this work in particular, as well as actually I think Polidori's for me, begins to raise a question about, that's a little problematic. This work is so gobsmackingly beautiful that it can become very easy to just fall into this kind of romantic ecstasy of, you know, contemplating the post-industrial sublime. And in the process, it can elide over issues of human agency and also the consequences of the events that have happened. So I began to start thinking about this kind of work and wondering, are there other ways of doing this kind of retrospective work that open up a little more and deal a little more with the civic space? And I want to make one thing clear here, is that what I'm fretting about here isn't the aesthetic merits of the work. It's really this question about, I'm thinking of it as a citizen, really. How did this happen, and what's happened to the people who were left behind? So one person I thought of in this light was Jonathan Dorgovnik and his Intended Consequences series. This is pictures of children, Rwandan children born of rape in the Rwandan genocide. And Turgovnik in this work, I think, particularly in the double portraits of the mother and the children, really succeeds in bringing a human face to this issue. Another candidate, Edward Tinsky, certainly no stranger to the post-industrial sublime. This is from his extended oil series about oil. And what's interesting to me about this work is that because he traces the entire story of the way that oil courses through the global economy, this is California oil fields on the left and shipbreaking in Bangladesh on the right, so the beginning and the end of oil. But because he includes the consumption, he doesn't really let us off the hook. And my third guy, and I have to say my favorite, is Alfredo Yar and his six-year project, Rwanda Project, which was a multimedia project that drew heavily on photography, not exclusively a photographic project. But I think it deals with some of these questions that I have about how the image plays out in the public sphere. Yar, by his own admission, became rather obsessed with the topic, with what had happened in Rwanda, and he went there very shortly after the genocide ended in August of 1994, traveled around the country and took something like 3,000 pictures. But he didn't really know what to do with them. So his first project actually happened more or less on site. He collected a lot of Rwandan tourist postcards, and at the same time, he had been writing down the names of people who'd survived the genocide. And he sent the postcards out to people and the friends and colleagues in the rest of the world, with messages on them that said things like, "Caritas, Nazimuru is alive." But he had to actually send them from Uganda because the Rwandan postal system wasn't working. This piece is the first piece, the next piece that he did in this series. He was invited to do a public presentation, a public art presentation in Sweden. And he'd been very disturbed by the fact that neither the news nor the news photographs coming out of Rwanda had really succeeded in capturing our attention. So he thought maybe if he just yelled at people, it would work. And these posters were posted around a number of cities in Europe at the time. His next piece in this project, and there were about 26, I think, individual projects within the larger umbrella project, he actually does begin to deal with the images themselves, although he entombs them. He built black boxes that he had selected 60 of these thousands of photographs that he had taken, and he put a photograph in each of these black boxes and then inscribed on the top of the box a description of the photograph itself. And he calls this is the name of the name of this particular piece was Real Pictures, and he describes it as a cemetery of images. After this, though, he actually seems able to unearth the photographs themselves, and I'll just show you one of them. This is a piece called The Silence of Enduesu, who was a five-year-old boy who saw his parents macheted to death and didn't speak for a month thereafter. Yar met him in one of the refugee camps and took this photograph on the right, and then for this installation made this mountain of slides, displayed them on a slide, on a light table, and when you looped them, you looked into the eyes of this child who had seen what he saw. So clearly this is not photo documentary in any conventional sense of the term. I think it's more like conceptual photo documentary. But to me, it's quite powerful, and it raises a lot of these issues that I'm concerned about, I'm interested in, about how to reanimate the photograph and how to bring it back into the public discourse and how to make these events live for us in a way that I think classic photojournalism did do back in the day. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming today. I'm Daniel Traub. I guess the approach I'm taking as the photographer on the panel is a little different. I guess I'm going to talk more about my own work and sort of the challenges that I've struggled with in doing it. Just to give you some background, I lived in China for about 9 years from 1999 to 2007. And I worked as a documentary film cameraman and an editorial photographer, and all the while also doing my own personal projects. I guess just to give you a sense, I guess photography is something I've been doing for, I guess, 20 years, and it's always been an endeavor that kind of gives me a way of understanding the world and kind of moving forward with my own life. It's something very personal and in a way that kind of gives me a sense of self, like the process of working. I kind of look out into the world and find a kind of resonance within myself, or look for images that provide me with that. And in a way, the images that work for me become sort of like touchstones for moving forward with my life. So I guess I'll go forward with that. I want to show you a couple of different projects that I've worked on. The first one is called The Simplified Characters. It's a project that I worked on over a five-year period when I first moved to China. I went there after graduate school, and I really didn't know what I was really looking after. I was sort of looking for, on the one hand, my own connection to China. My mother's Chinese, and I was trying to kind of understand my relationship to China. And so I kind of wandered the streets of Beijing with a medium format camera and just kind of randomly took pictures. But gradually, I came to look at the cityscapes, and I found this kind of garishness and kind of two-dimensional quality, almost like stage sets. There was a sense that everything was impermanent, constantly under construction, and this kind of very rawness that I was drawn to. And I guess I was trying to find my own visual language to talk about my experience there. So I would go around and photograph billboards and also people that I encountered. And I started to look at, in a way, how, like the backdrops, like the posters and billboards, had a theatrical quality. Also, the people, there was something very theatrical. Like people would present themselves in kind of dress in certain ways and had certain kind of facial features. Particularly, people coming from outside the city would come to to Beijing and Shanghai, and kind of reinvent themselves. So there was a sense of, in a way, acting, performing for a new world. So this became a series that I wasn't really sure what I was doing, but I was just kind of going out and photographing, and kind of searching for my own voice or kind of visual language to talk about this. And I guess the title, Simplified Characters, I was thinking about what Mao did to the written language. He abbreviated it and simplified it. And in a way, I was using that as a kind of frame of reference or metaphor to talk about my experience of China as a whole. There was a sense that the culture is somehow disconnected from its own traditions. You know, somehow it's taking in all this information from the West and somehow not quite in sync with itself. It's sort of it's reinventing itself and searching for something new. And so I use that as a sense, as a kind of way to look at what China is now, kind of the sense of not being connected, and I guess what I was looking for, in a way, it was a kind of authenticity, a way to look beyond the surfaces. I mean, there was something very superficial that I was seeing, and I wanted to see, in a way, what new was going to come out of this all these kind of mixes of different elements that I was looking for. So there's more of this kind of very theatrical quality. So the next project that I started working on over the last 2 or 3 years that I was in China is called City's Edge. And this project I did with a large format camera, and I was looking at specifically the outskirts of the East Coast cities like China, like Shanghai, Beijing, and Guangzhou. And I guess what really interested me is the border region between urban and rural China, the sense of these two worlds kind of colliding, the ancient agricultural region and the urban. And my feeling was that this kind of created this very surreal environment with all kinds of unusual elements. There were migrant worker squatter shanty towns, gated communities, industrial parks, and all sorts of kind of surreal places. And also this area was constantly in flux. One day, a farm would be there. The next day, a whole new hotel complex would be under construction. And also the you got the sense of the degradation of the environment. Kind of all of the major issues that China is struggling with were kind of encapsulated in this area. This particular image is a region outside of Shanghai, or a kind of a migrant community, where they take the demolition of windows and doorways that happening in Shanghai, and kind of create the secondary market. And on the left side is a luxury villa where that was abandoned, and then this migrant community moved in and created this shanty town. So this is kind of an example of the type of places that I would find there, and just the sense of very complex, very complex environments. And this whole area has already been demolished and has disappeared. And this is a gated community in outside of Guangzhou, this kind of very wealthy community. But I guess the challenge that I want to talk about is I spent 2 years kind of struggling to find these images. You know, my process is very solitary and lonely, in my feeling. And it took me just kind of just a lot of struggle to kind of go out every day. But I guess there was always this sense that I was finding things that were of value and somehow resonated with me. And kind of looking at the world, I sort of found something that was kind of gave me some understanding and made it worthwhile and kind of kept me moving out and continuing this work. This is a itinerant burlesque show that's also something very specific to the outskirts of the city. They perform for other migrant workers, and they have to stay within the outskirts of the city. So I guess what in this whole body of work, what really interests me is just the eclectic nature of this. What you never know what you're going to find in this area. And it just has this kind of strange mix of people and architecture and environments. This is a migrant dwelling outside of Beijing. Again, I've always been attracted to these very complex environments that are kind of very rich and visually complex. This is outside of Beijing, kind of a new area that's been planted with trees, and a man reading. So in 2008, I decided to move back to the States, and I wanted to leave China and start to photograph in the U.S. again. And I guess because I grew up in Philadelphia, it seemed like an obvious place to start working again. And I actually spent time working at a project that my mother started when I was a kid. When I was a teenager in called the Village of Arts and Humanities, and I had a lot of exposure to the people and the environments and kind of the vacant lots. The project was kind of transforming vacant lots into sculpture gardens and community projects, and I was somehow in China. That project kind of stayed in my mind, and I wanted to kind of look at it, and it seemed like a place to kind of start photographing in America again. So I started it pretty randomly, just driving around and searching for not really knowing what I was looking for, but just kind of wanting to engage with this environment. And so I started taking portraits and looking at architecture in vacant lots. And it became a way for me to kind of talk to people and interact with people. And again, I guess the difficulty was I had a lot of difficulty sort of just being in these spaces and being in these neighborhoods. But somehow I just felt that the images kind of triggered something in me that I felt was important, and it just kind of compelled me to keep working. And finally, the last project that I did was kind of out of photographing in North Philadelphia. I kind of came to the sense of I found this kind of form of these vacant lots that I found very kind of poignant. These one lots that are still surrounded and framed by two existing buildings, and I was kind of interested in how these two buildings frame this kind of hidden landscape. I was interested in how nature kind of reshapes and retakes hold of these spaces, and I started doing a typology of these spaces and how they each one has kind of its own character and its own form. And these spaces. Originally, there was a building there which was either burnt down or abandoned, and they had to be torn down. Thank you.
Okay, so once again, if you have a question, please find somebody, call someone over who has a microphone, and speak into the microphone as you ask your question. And I think we see a question down here if the mic wants to come down.
If the documentary photographer had fine arts orientation, as some of these image makers seem to have, as compared to documenters with no fine arts, who created images that the content was more important by the imagery than the form. Now, since the word documentary is supposed to show reality for forensic, documentary, medical photography, which is pure documentary. You're not supposed to have any glitter to it, any sales content. Can you address the fact that and some of the creations of these two different trained people, like people who are not oriented towards fine arts, but are more interested in pure documentary, like war photographers. Some of them.
So the question is: so can you to address the differences between documentary, right? Address the differences between documentary, pure documentary, and fine art photography. Can you just make the distinctions? Is that correct?
Yes. Great. Examples,
okay.
Of people who are more concerned with content than form.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Well, I'll take a quick stab at that. I think that they both coexist now, and they actually even coexist within the photo education system, the whole new topographic school that I think Nancy referred to briefly is a very deliberately neutral look at the environment, the man-made environment, the way that especially the human environment has impinged on nature in various places, and it mirrors the photographic techniques of the 19th century landscape photographers and of photographers who basically as working photographers document construction sites, etc. I'm thinking here of the work of people like Louis Baltz, for example, and Joe Deal. Mark Klett's re-photography project very deliberately replicates the photographic procedures of William Henry Jackson and George Barnard and a number of people who did survey work for the U.S. government, again, with no stylistic, deliberate stylistic infliction, although in a certain way he's kind of reproducing the style of those photographers, but those photographers were not working with a fine art purpose and trying to create a signature visual style. Those both of those approaches exist. A highly stylized documentary approach or approach to what we would broadly call documentary, street photography, social landscape photography in the work of people like Lee Friedlander, Robert Frank, Gary Winogrand, and a much more neutral, deliberately neutral approach to the issue of documentation in the work of a wide range of photographers. They're both there, and they're both taught or accepted as approaches within the photo education system.
Okay,
Your last comment, Alan, in your speech was about what the photographer does. Mm-hmm. So much of the previous part was all about distribution and how do you get it out there and so on. And I'm looking at Daniel there, and I'm thinking, what suggestion would you have for a young photographer? It seemed to me there should be distribution specialists so the photographers can make the photographs and immerse themselves in that process. And all the things you said about getting it out there seemed separate to me. But they're not to you, I'm sure. So can you give him a suggestion, maybe?
You want me to give Daniel a suggestion? Well, you know, as a writer, I feel exactly the way you feel. I'm supposed to have an agent, you see, who's going to go out and do all that stuff for me, and I just get to sit and do my writing. And let me tell you, it doesn't happen. At least it doesn't happen until you reach the level of a Stephen King, let's say. And Daniel, whose work I admire, has not yet reached the level of a Stephen King in his field. And so it's not going to happen for him. An agent is not going to come knocking on his door and saying, Daniel, you just make photos, now I'm going to take care of the rest. So Daniel is going to have to and all of these other photographers are going to have to figure out how to do business for themselves and how to subsidize their work. Or they're going to go take a day job and subsidize it, which is a perfectly legitimate way of doing it. But if they want to subsidize the work through the work, then they have to be engaging with these issues of distribution and rights management, etc. Because until they reach a certain level, or unless they reach a certain level, no one else is going to do it for them.
I'd just like to say that I think today there are more venues for people like me to show their work. I mean, there's online magazines, and it's possible to do your own photo books quite cheaply. So I think there's more opportunity, but also a lot more photographers out there as well.
Hello. When people view pictures, they have a kind of a visceral reaction to pictures, even though we know that even an eighth grader knows that they could have been, quote, photoshopped, and the word is now a verb. And I'm wondering about this transition from people who look at pictures, people who organize pictures, people who make pictures, and how much are you thinking about that now and how that has really changed some very, very subtle things that cannot be discerned by even a professional that have changed these images?
Thanks, Alan.
Oh, come on. We've got to share this here.
Well, really? I have to tell you, you have to repeat the question for me, please.
Well, I think the question basically has to do with the veracity of the photograph now.
Who believes in the photograph anymore?
The veracity of the photograph then. Yeah. But, you know, we can go back. You know, Nancy was showing the George Barnard photographs of the, you know, Charleston and the Civil War, which were not faked. But we have photographs from the Civil War that were faked, or the situations were changed by the photographer, Alexander Gardner, in the case of the death of a rebel sharpshooter photograph, that were changed by the photographer before he made the photograph. So on some level, the power of documentary has always depended on the photographer in some way saying to us, I was the man, I saw it, I was there. I mean, saying basically, this happened. You know, I saw this happened. You know, Goya wrote that on some of his disasters of war. You know, I saw this happened. Right? An etching, right? When photographers undercut that without a deliberate intention to challenge the tradition of documentary and challenge our assumptions, it in some ways it weakens the form, I guess we'd say.
Well, yes, and I think also that it's always an interpretation, and it's always been an interpretation, and it's always we have more, there's more plasticity available now. It's easier to do, but people have always been doing it. People have always been manipulating the actual image, but also simply manipulating the situation by choosing how they frame something, what they frame, what they take. So it's all, you always have to be aware of anything that purports to be a document is a flawed document. So I don't think that's changed in some way. It's just gotten a little easier to do. It's gotten easier for everybody to do.
Yeah, it's not the situation. It's the photographer's report on that situation, the photographer's interpretation of that situation. When we look at Daniel's photographs, we're not seeing China. We're seeing Daniel's China. And that's always been true. That's not new, right? And people have always, and I kind of maybe question Nancy's use of the word manipulation. I don't think you're manipulating the scene when you pick an angle from which to view it. The scene is the scene, whatever it is. That's the stuff out there, right? You may be manipulating the image or simply defining the image when you move, you know, 10 steps to the left or whatever. But those decisions are crucial decisions because they shape the picture. And what we're coming to finally, and it's only taken us a century and a half plus a decade or two to do this, is the realization that these are, in fact, interpretations, that isn't the situation, that's a report on the situation. You know? And an idiosyncratic report filtered through the personality of the photographer, filtered through the technology itself, which has its own built-in biases.
I think it's also a kind of a matter of degrees with Photoshop. I mean, I adjust the color and contrast and things like that, but I would never, you know, put something that's not there or take something out that's not there. So I think in a way it's about kind of saying what it is that you're doing. I mean, there was one instance, I guess, a couple years ago with a New York Times magazine assignment where a photographer did a project about
interiors, right?
Yeah, interiors across the country.
Edgar Martins.
Edgar Martins, and he, you know, the mission of the Times is that it has to be a documentary photograph. It can't be altered. Mm-hmm. But he's actually a fine art photographer who also said that he doesn't manipulate his images, but it was very clear in the image that he had cloned things in Photoshop and had kind of taken elements and doubled them over. So it was very obvious that he did that, but he claimed not to. So I think to some extent it's just a matter of saying what you do, kind of being clear about whether or not you're manipulating or not. I mean, it doesn't matter if you do or not, but you just have to be honest about it, I think.
Yeah. But we were facing these problems before digital came along. We were facing these problems with Robert Boisneau's The Kiss in front of the Hotel de Ville, right? Which for half a century was this wonderful picture of romance in Paris and then suddenly becomes a movie still, you know, when it turns out that they're two paid actors or models. You know, feigning a kiss in front of the Hotel de Ville. It's exactly the same photograph. He didn't change a pixel. Yeah. He didn't change a silver particle of that original negative. It's still the identical physical thing, but the response to it that I have as a member of the audience has changed completely. It's gone from sociology to theater.
Yeah.
And instead of committing my belief to his assertion, which he did assert that this was real, you know, found, you know, street experience, instead of committing my belief, which is what I do with sociology, I now have to suspend my disbelief, which is what I do with theater. That's asking something very different of me as audience, as viewer.
I think that's very much to Daniel's point. It depends on if you know what you're looking at, you calibrate your response.
Continuing the discussion between the tension between art and documentation, I could mention Picasso's Guernica, where he's depicting something, or Goya, something very, very terrible, and yet he produces, I think, a beautiful painting in terms of its composition, colors, line, forms, and all that. I mean, people stand back. Well, it's a nice-looking painting. So my question is it an inescapable reality that in any image-making there's an aesthetic dimension, or to put another way, is can the ugly be beautiful, or in photography, inevitably is the ugly beautiful?
Well, I don't think you want to make ugly pictures. I think that I mean we've had what 200. Years of romantic, a romantic response to beautiful ruins. Are they ugly? I don't know, but yes. So I mean, I think it's a very complicated, complicated issue. And in the work that I was showing, I think they're beautiful pictures. The thing that troubles me is if that's where they stop. Hmm. And I don't have an objection to taking photographs of these disasters and finding beauty in them. But if that's all you find, then I think you're really in some kind of decadent place that I don't want to live. Does that answer your question?
Well, maybe the term beauty is the problematic term here. I think the challenge is how do you make an image?
Somebody gets pleasure, okay? Picasso and Guernica, and it gives a kind of visual pleasure, call it beauty or whatever. It resonates on some kind of aesthetic level.
I think things are allowed to be complicated.
This is complicated, and there's no answer.
Yeah.
There's no answer to my question. I just raise it.
Yeah. No, I think certainly Picasso's Guernica can give us pleasure and also disturb us. I mean, I see no necessary contradiction.
But an image that doesn't draw and hold our attention is not going to engage us with whatever its subject matter is or whatever its quote-unquote content is. Because form and content are inseparable. The picture has to have some kind of visual power. Now, whether we call that beauty, which is a vague and increasingly sort of problematic term, or whether you want to use the term aesthetic, which is a term that has absolutely no meaning at all, except unless you go back to the original Greek, which is shock, we all think we know what we're talking about. I don't know what you're talking about. That's the problem. We'd have to sit down for hours and define it in order to know what we're talking about mutually. But the issue is how do you make an image that is powerful and draws the attention and the viewer's concentration on the material that you're trying to present to them, the idea, the information, the experience, etc., that you're trying to engage them with, without simply seducing them into a kind of pleasurable enjoyment of the sensory appeal of the delicious red of the blood of a torture victim, let's say, right? How do you do that? That's, I think, always the challenge in any kind of and anything other than really blunt reportage, you know, any kind of real interpretation of an event. How do you retain the power of it? And sometimes the answer is the most strict and neutral description possible. You know, Pablo Neruda in his famous poem about the Spanish Civil War. There's a passage in which he is trying to describe the effect of a bombing on the city that he was living in during the Spanish Civil War. And the line goes in translation, the blood of the children in the streets was like, and he's searching, you can see the poet searching for an analogy. And he concludes the line, the blood of the children in the streets was like the blood of the children in the streets. Meaning, there's no image more powerful than that, that all you need to say is the blood of the children in the streets. And that tells you everything you need to know. So sometimes you need to restrain or even suppress the poetics, even the poetics of your own inclination, in that kind of situation, in order to let the brute facts speak for themselves. Right? And then sometimes you need in some way to enhance those poetics in order to evoke the hidden horror that may not be visible. I think that's an ongoing challenge for everybody who does that kind of work.
Okay, I'm actually going to get to ask the last question, sorry, but it's 5:20, so it's already well past when we were planning to go. You know, I think when we say challenges of the 21st century to documentary photography, a lot of people would easily say digital veracity, challenges to veracity, they'd say economics and whatever, but something that really hasn't come up, I don't think anyone has said the word postmodern today. And I think probably the only work that we saw that might be considered postmodern is Alfred Ayar's work. So my question is, and certainly Daniel's work, you know, I think is not postmodern, or at least doesn't engage with, you know, that discussion or that theory. So is postmodern, the postmodern critiques, postmodern theory, postmodern practice, which are so, you know, universal in the other art forms and even in fine art photography perhaps, does it have any relevance within the term documentary photography? And if so, what? And I guess that's mostly aimed at you, Nancy.
Well, I mean, that's why I put Yar in there. Because I think he's really more of a conceptual artist than anything. He's not a photographer, by his own admission. Actually, he was trained as an architect. So I think there's a place for it, but I suspect it's quite small. Because, honestly, I don't know what the market for it is. I mean, I think it's going to be a very rarefied group of people who are going to be able to engage with it. And perhaps I'm not being terribly fair to my fellow citizens, but I do think it's something that's going to happen more in the academy than it is out in the street. The internet may fool me on that, but I think it's too heady. Alan, do you?
Well, it's a while back, but at roughly the same time, Sebastio Salgado had a retrospective at the George Eastman House in Rochester, New York, and Martha Rosler had a retrospective at the ICP in New York. And there were lines around the block for the Salgado show, and there were no lines around the block for the Rosler show. Now, this may tell us that you know, that the New York audience is unsophisticated and doesn't know what, you know, good, great documentary work or post-documentary work when it sees it. But my experience is that the citizenry, for better or worse, our fellow citizens, at least here in this country, have a serious appetite for serious classical or documentary projects and less of an appetite for postmodern documentary projects. And that may just mean that they need to be educated towards that postmodern stuff, but it may mean that postmodern stuff has yet to find an audience, as Nancy's saying, sort of outside of an academic context. And may not.
Okay, I think we should end it here and thank our panelists.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.